All right. Welcome back, everybody. Here we are once again. It is the Dom and Colin podcast here to talk about the double episode of Survivor Edge of Extinction. I'm Colin alongside Dom. Dom, how are you?
I'm not bad. I'm making it through the day, but you're flourishing, right? You're thriving here in 2019.
Am I thriving? This is potentially breaking news to me. Is there some reason in particular that I'm thriving?
You just seem like a fairly chipper, happy type of individual. I don't know.
Well, thank you. I'll happily take that. I guess my March Madness bracket is not yet busted, which is always the goal of the first week of the tournament. I assume you've been closely glued to the TV for the last 4 days?
I've not been closely glued to the TV, but I have been closely glued to your updates about March Madness. And my bracket, which I filled out entirely at random, by the way, was doing distressingly well for quite a long time here, beating out people who actually put genuine thought and care into choosing their bracket. But luckily, we have reverted to the mean, I guess the phrase would be, and I and all the other people I knew who chose at random are now solidly at the bottom. So I'm glad that order has been restored.
Right. Variance has regressed to the mean. And for the record, I believe my advice to you was to pick the all chalk bracket. I thought that would be like the classic Dom move to just constantly pick the higher seeds. And as things have played out, all four number one seeds, all four number two seeds, all four number three seeds, and two of the four number four seeds have made it to the Sweet 16. So I think you would be in first place if you would listen to me.
If I had understood what that meant and realized that the bracket contained seeds in it, then I think I would be doing a lot better right about now.
That was very funny, is finding out that Dom did not understand that the numbers next to each team's name indicated the likelihood of them winning their respective matchups, and they weren't just random opponents.
I figured the numbers were some obscure statistic that sports nerds like you would love to dive into. I didn't realize they were fundamental information to understanding how the entire thing worked.
I mean, I just was blown away by, surely you've seen a tournament of some variety before, use seeding as like the methodology for determining matchups, right?
I'm just going to blame the interface on this one.
Okay. I guess you probably not the most experienced. You are probably not the most experienced user of ESPN.com. But Dom, enough of that. We have a lot to be getting into today with these 2 hours of Survivor since we last spoke. And let's dive into it. And I think the thing to do this week is probably not worry as much as we maybe sometimes do about chronology and hit the big kind of talking points leading into the merge in a much looser order potentially than is normal. But I think one potentially smart move is to just get all of the Edge of Extinction stuff out of the way up front and then focus on the main game, because this was quite an action-packed week on the Edge of Extinction. And I think let's just start there and get all of that out of the way up front. So we start with Rick arriving at Edge of Extinction after his shocking elimination in the previous episode, and we see he seems to have like a good attitude and is maintaining positivity and still seems to be delivering in the confessionals. And we end up seeing the Edge of Extinction people get these coded maps that Rick is the one who ends up figuring out. And this map is ultimately going to lead to an advantage, a couple of advantages, actually. Before we get into like Keith running off and things of that nature, what do you just make up front of the people on Edge of Extinction having what could potentially become an increasing role in what is going on in the main game itself?
I don't mind it, given that you have the twist in there in the first place, because they need to have something to do. And knowing that only one person, I hope, we don't even know how the mechanics are going to work here, but we hope that only one person will be coming back for each stage. So I imagine the way it's going to work is when we get to the merge this upcoming week, one person's going to come back. That will reset Edge of Extinction. Everyone else will go home, or I guess just go back straight back to Edge of Extinction, and then more people will gradually start trickling in, and then there'll be one big blowout contest towards the end to decide the second returnee. But until that point, if you're someone who is just chilling out there on Edge of Extinction for 28 days, you can suffer in silence, or you can get involved in the game in some way. And I think it's much more interesting if there is a fan favorite who goes home, or goes home ahead of time. You want them to have some kind of agency within the game and not just be sitting out there waiting potentially in vain for their chance to actually do something.
Well, I think the question that I was driving at is, I agree with wanting a potential fan favorite who gets eliminated early to have some screen time on the show still, but agency within the game, I could at least see being potentially some kind of murky territory for some people.
Right, but I think that borderline has already been crossed with the twist in the first place. And at that point, you may as well lean into it and accept it for what it is and find ways to improve it rather than just sticking your fingers in your ears and pretending this never happened.
That's what I was wondering is I could see at least an argument being made for giving the people on Edge of Extinction a little influence within the game, potentially being almost less offensive than not doing so. To almost, I guess, in a sense, validate having this twist in the first place. It does seem logical that the eliminated players would have more of a say.
And knowing that some of these people are going to be on the jury at some point, they will still have agency in the game when we get to the finale. I don't think there's anything categorically different about giving them a taste of that now. If anything, just to keep them engaged in the game. Like, if I'm Keith and I've been there and I'm already sick of everyone who I'm there with and I'm just thinking about how to make it through the day and what comes next, I think it's useful to keep me at least engaged thinking about, okay, how can I interact with this one person in so that in the 2% chance that I make it back in myself, I have this relationship there or I can at least work through these different scenarios. And so when I end up on the jury, I've at least been primed to care about this in a way that maybe I wouldn't have been otherwise.
Let's talk about Keith quickly here for a minute. As I referenced, Rick pieces together the kind of like Mad Magazine style fold the page and unlock the hidden key.
Did you like that, by the way? Because it felt like he figured it out pretty much instantaneously and everyone knew what the deal was. And that specific map, it looked like any prop, like old school treasure map that you would see on any production set ever, right? Like there was nothing really distinct about it.
But I think that's what they were going for, as far as I could tell, is having it be kind of that classic looking kind of treasure map idea with a hidden code to it.
I guess so. It just felt like maybe they're recycling some old props from the CBS art department.
So to answer your question, I did very much like that they, instead of just giving them a map where X marks the spot, there is some element of you need to outthink your opponents to get an advantage here.
Yeah, and to be fair, when the players left in the game are finding idols just by walking around like woodland copses and sticking their hands in trees, I don't think that, you know, there's much less effort involved in anything that Rick did here.
Mm-hmm. So on to Keith and his decision once Rick gives the kind of answer key away to everyone on Exile Island. We see Keith take off on his own for whatever that map is leading to. And I think it kind of raises an interesting concept for Edge of Extinction and being one of the people out there who's never seen this specific twist in play or really anything like this in play before. Would you, Dom, be at all nervous about the political game on Edge of Extinction, or would you be taking it for granted? Only one of us is going back in. I don't really have to worry about burning bridges. The way it seems, Keith is not too worried about burning any of these bridges.
My first instinct might be that it's an outcast-style thing where we're going to vote one of our own back in. And so there is going to be a parallel social game, political game going on over here. And it might get twisted around the way that Lil gets voted out of the outcast and back into the game because they just didn't want to spend any more time with her. So maybe that's one angle you could pursue if you have that historical precedent in mind. But I would just take it at face value and think, okay, if there is anything where I'm going to be like elected as a leader or just voted to go back in or anything, I actually want to be in contention for that and not be completely written off by everyone in advance.
I think that would be my impulse as well, is just having only that Pearl Islands outcast twist as a frame of reference. I don't know if I would be advocating for be as cutthroat as possible to get whatever advantages you can while you're out there, because on one hand,
thank God that these people aren't taking that attitude. I love that Reem is just tearing people apart the moment they arrive, and then Keith is going rogue and clambering around and trying to find things for himself. They're doing their best to keep a potentially stale twist very interesting, and I salute them for that.
Yeah, I'm sure. I just take it for granted that a solid at least 80 or 90% of our listeners also listen to RHAP, and I one of my hashtag calling my shot calls, C-O-L-I-N, my shot calls, from early.
I get it.
Yes, thank you. From early this season is I think Rob's Reem impression is going to end up on the RHAP impression Mount Rushmore. His Reem is so strong already.
It is really good, and I don't know what that says. Does that say more about Rob or about Reem, do you think?
I think it says a lot about both of them. I mean, Rob, I honestly, as weird as it is and kind of meta as it is to be talking about Rob on a different Survivor podcast, his impressions do go, people enjoy them, but his actual talent at impressions, I really do think, doesn't get enough credit. Not right, to suck kneecaps. I'm sorry for going off on this kind of tangent.
Well, I'm glad that Reem has enabled Rob to flourish in a way that he really hasn't been allowed to up until this point.
Yeah, good to see Rob finally catch a break. Dom, one other thing as far as the Edge of Extinction has been concerned that really didn't cross my mind until last week, but has subsequently consumed my entire existence, is the idea that it's at least possible, if not getting to the point for me of one of the most likely, if not most likely outcomes, that no one ever ends up quitting. It seems like, obviously, no one's going to quit before this re-entry challenge. And then I would guess if no one says after losing that challenge that they've had enough, I'm not sure who over the course of the rest of the season is going to end up raising that mast at any point. Where are you on that right now? As we are about to enter the merge, over under 0.5 total quitters on this season.
Well, I said earlier that we don't know how this is going to work. Maybe I don't know this how this is going to work, because you seem to be very confident that they will just be sent right back to exile there, back to Edge of Extinction if they lose this upcoming challenge.
I think I've already said exile twice over the course of this episode, so you are forgiven. And I don't know for a fact that that's how it's going to work, but I believe I remember seeing when I first like read about the twist on when Redmond broke it on Inside Survivor that is how it is going to work. And I believe that is why people are talking about the prospect of a 15-person jury potentially being
okay. Yeah, because I can imagine some fatigue coming into play where if you just get demolished in this first challenge, you get sent right back there, and let's say Joe gets voted out in 2 episodes time, you might think, okay, I've had enough. But realistically, I'm not coming back in. All I'd be doing is just wasting away out here. And to be fair, Joe is a fantastic provider, so if he's so inclined, maybe life isn't going to be so bad for us. But, not to put myself in Keith's shoes once again, I'm not sure why that's the example I keep going back to. But, like, if I've been there for that long, I lose a challenge, it's not even close, and then the prospect of a second challenge in 18 days, which I'm surely going to lose once again, maybe it's best to just call it quits then and there. But with this new batch of people who get sent, as you said, no one's leaving before this challenge. And then the people who come afterwards, I don't know what would be different about their position necessarily to make them more or less likely to quit. So yeah, if we haven't had any quitters so far, then as long as that first group can hold their nerve, I think we might be taking the under here. We might be getting zero total quitters.
Yeah, which is, again, just something I thought was very low likelihood, I guess, just sight unseen entering the season. But I'm really having a hard time coming up with reasons people would find to quit once they've arrived, and it's not the worst thing they've ever experienced in their lives, or maybe it is the worst, but it's not as bad to the point that it would induce them to quit, unless I think the real window of quitting is going to be right after this re-entry challenge. Someone like a Keith could say it's not worth it to stick around, but
there is also the chance that Reem just ends up trying to murder Wendy, which is definitely in play, especially if they end up there for 2 weeks or so. So if we're bundling like medevacs or whatever in there too, then maybe that changes the odds a bit.
Yeah, we'll see how that ends up going, but quite a surprising possibility for me. Seems certainly not overwhelmingly likely, but it may be my call for most likely outcome at this point is zero quitters, which is pretty wild to think about. Only five weeks, I guess, into the season, but still plenty of time for things to change drastically on that front, I'm sure. Dom, anything else from you on Edge of Extinction? I'm sure we'll talk a little about Aubrey and that extra vote later, but did you have any thoughts on like Rick's decision to give it to specifically her, I guess?
That was interesting, only insofar as we heard nothing from him about it. You know, we just cut to Aubrey receiving a gift in her bag one day. What do you think was the mindset that went into that? Was it like, well, I want my previous tribe to be taken down, and the most likely person to be able to do that is a capable returnee over on another tribe? Or what do you think his thought process was?
I'm currently live on air spacing on the other person that he had as a choice. It was Eric, Victoria, Aubrey, Wendy, and who was the other person? Whom was the other? Who was the other
who
person?
Cares? Whom cares? That he could... Whatever. So yeah, Eric, Gavin, did you mention?
No, I did not, because that is the person I was forgetting.
Perfect. Case closed. So, you know, do you see any reason why he would or wouldn't give it to any of the others instead?
Nothing jumps out at me. Just he hasn't spent any time with any of them other than Wendy at that point, and that would at least be a consideration for me, just having spent some time with Wendy and knowing what a wild card she could potentially be. But like, just having that extra vote in there could potentially swing things for her. Based on what I guess don't know about the rest of the other people on that tribe, I think Aubrey is a logical enough person just to open the door for, like, in whatever timeline exists where I get to come back later in the game, it would probably be good to have Aubrey still there as a potentially big target compared to one of these other people I know nothing about.
Yeah, and it's a good way to get in her good graces if she does end up maintaining power, as you see it, through that merge. So yeah, but maybe a good long con there for Rick. The other thing too is, I wonder if that twist being in there is another subtle or not so subtle way to help those returning players out, where, let's say, Lauren had been voted out early, which, for as much as it may have seemed close to happening, it seems like she is completely safe and in a very good position right now. But let's say she had been sent there in episode 3, and then she now has to make this decision. If she's been a fan of Joe and Kelly for the past, you know, few years, and she has nothing else to go on based on who's on the other tribe, you might just give it to the person that you really wish had won that previous season, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think it hurts to be a returning player in that capacity, although over the course of this episode, I will say that the conspiracy theories about production helping returning players, I would hope at least, after this week, are going to be taken down a notch after Aubrey ends up sitting on that idol that they pretty easily could have tipped her off for.
The conspiracies theory of it all?
Yes, thank you. And, you know, normally I'm a big fan of conspiracies theory, but this week I would definitely say may not be the week to dive too deep down those rabbit holes. Mm-hmm. Rabbit's hole.
Thank you.
Yeah. All right. So maybe some other stuff from Edge of Extinction will come up along the way, but let's dive into the real heart of the game, I suppose, at this point. And I want to start with something I know I've talked about before, and I promise this will be the last time this season that this comes up, because we are next week going to be done with the entire pre-merge portion, and I am just going to put a personal moratorium on not driving this point too hard into the ground immediately. So for the last time before season 39, I want to just quickly get into the idea of at this first reward challenge, we once again see the green team just get completely destroyed at least the physical element of it. And we see yet again that in these kind of three tribe formats that for such a long time we were big proponents of and advocating for, they need to be putting them into three tribes way more often than they historically were in like the early 20s, seasons in the early 20s. It does seem like a major drawback to the three tribe format that we're seeing once again is, to put it in Boston Rob terms, one tribe has a tendency to pretty quickly become the buffoon tribe. And it seems like we saw that again this season, where were it not for an historically insane comeback on a super high variance puzzle, we would have had one group of people go to literally every single vote pre-merge. And as it played out, we did have one group of people go and cast votes to finish every episode for 5 weeks straight leading up to the merge. It was always the same people ending the episode casting votes, which is
And meanwhile, Joe has not been to a pre-merge vote since Worlds Apart, which is kind of insane to think
about.
Yeah,
it's crazy. But I want to just flag up for the final time, I promise, so much of this could be resolved, so many things I think could be resolved by a rule change where the people who are down in the numbers pick who sits out from the winning tribe. And I tweeted this sentiment last week and was immediately met with a bunch of people who I understand were thinking that that was not a great idea. It just punishes the physical players and it looks horrible when Joe is constantly sitting out. I promise, in practice, it is a massive safety net for the physical players. But because of that, like the optics of one team getting to sit Joe out of every other challenge, I am essentially already resigning the point that this will never happen. But I do think if the producers were willing to really examine this idea, they would find a lot of reasons to go for it.
I don't think you can invite someone like Joe back to have him not compete in challenges. Right. Like you, it's easy to write that off as just the optics of it all, but that is just the reality, right? That is part of what the idea of Joe is and of what you want the reality of Joe to be. So having him, you know, forcing him to get benched, you and I might appreciate like the strategic benefit of the losing team getting to place him there. But I don't think even for most viewers who think the way that we do, just that adds anything to have Joe be sidelined like that.
No, I agree. I think it had this been the rule since Borneo, I don't think many people would have an issue with it. And I think people would also realize the way this functions in practice is you cannot ever afford to not have multiple really strong physical competitors on your team. And simultaneously, you generally just can't afford to have multiple people who are total challenge liabilities because they're going to be forced to run every single challenge. And it obviously balances the challenges so much better than letting the best people run for the biggest teams every single time. And along with the kind of safety net it provides for the physical players, I think if they could see this actually play out in practice, which I, again, don't think we ever will, I think they would regret not having this be in play since season one, episode one, based on the things it seems like production prioritizes.
There are various game design ideas that you can kick around how to fix that problem. And I know Miles and I, actually, when I spoke to him, someone who has spent a lot of time and care thinking through all of these different angles, he mentioned the fact that goes under-recognized a lot, which is when you have three tribes, the challenges that you can design also have to look quite different. And that's, you know, if you're someone who watches for the challenges and maybe your Joe fandom is part of that, if you are, then that's something that you, even if you're not consciously thinking about it, it's going to affect your enjoyment of the show if they're being forced to do these less adventurous or less creative things because it's much harder to balance those for three tribes. Right. So that's another angle to it too. But I would like to believe that this is the last time we're going to talk about it. However, we've been through this song and dance before, so I have some lingering trust issues that hopefully will be resolved by the end of the season here.
Solemn vow, Dom. Last time until the pre-merge of season 39 rolls around. I just want everyone out there just know how much better it would be if that was the rule. End of lecture.
Noted.
Okay. One thing you just referenced that is a truly alarming stat when you compare it to, frankly, the resume of anyone else who has ever played Survivor, as far as I know, is Joe is now something like 19 for 20 or somewhere in that neighborhood of winning pre-merge immunity challenges, and obviously has plenty of personal immunity necklaces from post-merge portions of his season. On top of that, he is, over the course of this episode, going to go on to run the table yet again in pre-merge challenges and maintain that 50-plus day streak now, I think, of never voting anyone out of the game that goes back to his first season. He has never cast a ballot for someone who has left the game in like 50 to 55 days. You can check with Jeff Pittman over at True Dork Times for the exact number there, Dom. But what do we think just about the state of Joey Amazing and that legacy? Is there any chance that we could see him take any approach to this post-merge, or should he take any approach to this post-merge other than gun it in every single challenge imaginable because there is nothing that could prevent people from viewing him as a threat?
You do everything you can to win everything you can, but it might not matter, right? Like if he goes to Edge of Extinction, then even if you get the one shot to take him out after he wins four straight challenges the way he did in Cambodia to open that post-merge there, then he can just camp out there for the next 12, 14 days, and then he has to be the overwhelming favorite in whatever the returning challenge is. And I expect them to try to balance it so that it isn't obviously lopsided in favor of one person or another. But even despite that, you actively have to bias it to find a challenge that Joe is not going to be heavily favored in. And I don't think they're going to do that. So he has to be the massive favorite there. And so what odds would you give right now on Joe being in the game through whatever means possible, let's say the final five?
So at the final five, the way I'm going to do the math on Joe's odds of being there are essentially adding together the odds of Joe running the table to that point, be it with personal immunity or immunity idols, and add that to Joe's chance of being voted out and winning the reentry challenge at that point. And I would say the odds of him being voted out and winning the reentry challenge are probably pretty drastically higher than the odds of him being in the game at Final Five organically. I'm going to do some very rough, sketchy math and say to go from Final 12 through Final Five in the main game, I am going to give some single digit percentage of equity to Joe to run the table and stay immune that long. But to win the re-entry challenge, he's got to have, even if there are 10 people competing in it, a conservative 20 to 25% win equity at whatever the challenge is. So I would say we are looking at somewhere between like a 25 and 35% chance that Joe is back in the game or still in the game at Final Five. Does that sound roughly right to you, or are you going way higher?
That sounds plausible. And yeah, you might be undershooting, if anything. And when he does that, he then has, again, roughly the same chance, if not higher, of just winning the remaining immunities and getting to the end. And
right. Maybe there's going to be. He just needs to win the challenges, and he will crush anyone at Fire, as far as I can tell.
Yeah, so at Final Four, he's going to have two shots. So factor that in too. And maybe there's going to be some big backlash against him just sidestepping his way to the end if he manages to do that. But yeah, I think we could definitely be looking at this doomsday scenario that we flagged up when we first heard about this concept many months ago of nothing that happens in the main game matters, because if Joe can get to the merge, and a good way to do that is to just never lose a pre-merge challenge, as it turns out, then the odds of him being there in the end game are extraordinarily high. And for as much as there are other people in the conversation of who are the best challenge competitors of all time, like is it Ozzy, is it Terry, and so on, the only reason that Joe doesn't have that fifth win to tie that record or the sixth win to beat it is that he's been voted out before he can compete for that. So you look at Cambodia, he wins the first four and then gets voted out two rounds later. But if you're telling me that he wouldn't have won at least one of 7, 6, 5, 4 if he'd been able to compete in them, then there's no way he wouldn't have at least tied that record, right?
Right. Well, I think it is kind of an interesting consideration here. We saw in Cambodia, he was able to get through one vote post-merge. I believe it was when Steven got taken out. Steven used the extra vote to have Joe cast a vote onto Joe, and in so doing, ended his own game. The kind of dynamic where everyone knows for the first time all season, and we're getting pretty deep into things at this point, Joe is finally vulnerable. He doesn't have immunity, but they also know, what better time to blindside someone else when everyone thinks it's going to be coming on Joe? So Dom, over under 0.5 votes survived by Joe unimmune from this point forward.
I think I'm going to take the over, because at least for the first post-merge vote, that's the one that he is least likely to win just because of the sheer number of people there, even though you can say that's more likely to be an endurance or whatever. And then also, there's the biggest argument against going for Joe right then and there, because in the dark, you might assume Joe is likely to have an idol, right? He's exactly the type who ends up finding one, even though he hasn't done that in the past. And we've heard from Steven and others who...
Has he not? Joe's never had an idol?
No. Which is, and the fact that you're surprised by that shows just how, you know, natural it is to assume it. And we've heard from Steven and from others how in Cambodia, people just assumed, as a matter of fact, that of course Joe either does have an idol or is likely to have found one. So I would be worried if I have what I think is a clear shot at Joe, I don't know how clear it really is, because if he knows to play the idol, and he's, for as much as we give him crap, he's not a dumb guy. Like he has a sense of what's going on. then
he's a smart guy, for the record, as far as I've ever been able to see.
Absolutely. So there are also edge concerns, which we'll get on to in the edit zone later. But I think we are definitely over 0.5 vote survive without some kind of personal immunity.
Okay, so one interesting element there could be that original yellow team idol got found by Aubrey and then taken out of the game with, as far as I know, no one knowing that any of that happened. And there could be a lot of uneasiness about that yellow idol being unaccounted for at this first vote.
I wonder how much time Joe has spent searching for that idol by now.
A lot, I would imagine.
Yeah, and the fact that he hasn't been able to find it, what assumptions must he have been making? Because you arrive at exactly Aubrey found it and then went to another tribe and got voted out. But that's a big assumption to make in itself.
I would honestly say, in the modern era of Survivor, using day count is a little sketchy because sometimes you'll, as we see in this season, open up like a third beach and that throws things off. But if a beach has been played on for, I'm going to set an arbitrary number of 6 or 7 days, and I don't have the idol yet, I'm going to assume at that point it is gone.
Okay.
I think we are just way past the point where people are taking that long to find idols.
Would you earmark any one particular person as having found it?
I would not do so with the intention of then needing to rely upon that read. I'm sure I would have, like, equity distributions, Dom. You know me, in terms of Aubrey's a 40% favorite and Gavin's a 12% favorite and things of that nature. But I don't think I would be working too hard at trying to break down the likelihood of each person. I think I would just be chalking it up to, I don't have it, it's going to be somewhere out there, and now is the time to start figuring out where it is.
Does Joe have an ally in the game at this point, as far as you can tell?
None that we've seen, but
right.
I do also wonder, just because of how weird these teams were and the way the immunities fell, the entire pre-merge, if someone like Joe couldn't be very easily convinced to join up with a new group that comes together at this merge.
Yeah, and with how well that lesser group has stuck together and containing two of the returning players, two of the biggest threats, it would make sense for the remnants of the other two tribes to just band together and try and launch some kind of like counterattack against it, right?
Yeah, I definitely think that is going to be like the overwhelming dynamic, is these underdogs potentially trying to get together this coalition to take out a group that, quite frankly, seems pretty ready to take each other out.
Although, that said, the easiest way to do that, and we've seen this happen before, might be you take out the person who everyone in the game wants out, which is Joe, and then you band together and do the dirty work from there. And just leaving him in the game, if you get a chance to take him out, doesn't seem to do anything for anyone.
Well, I think, yeah, Joe is just such an anomaly when it comes to challenge reputation that the argument can always be made, we need to take the shot while we can, and that there's not really a great counterpoint to that unless there is a really tasty option on the table.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, speaking of really tasty options, Dom, we get some more chicken talk here on this new blue tribe, and I am so mad at myself for not thinking of titling last week's double episode coverage that was really going through Wendy and the chickens in a lot more depth. Wendy's spicy chicken combo last week. I really overlooked that, and I wish I could retcon that and make that last week's podcast title. But what can you do? You live and learn. And we see an Aubrey confessional, I guess, right away here on this new blue tribe. And despite Wendy really sticking out like a sore thumb based on the initial kind of tribe breakdown and also her less than stellar social game, Aubrey is a little perplexed about what's really going on here on this tribe and is wondering what's happening with the rest of these original comma people and stop drinking the Kool-Aid and wake up, and they need to start playing the game really for the first time. And we see pretty quickly that there's a lot more going on that Aubrey is not necessarily privy to, and it turns out Victoria is like the most diabolical. When's the last time we saw someone be as overtly diabolical as Victoria?
I can't remember, but I'm sure many, many suitable examples could come to mind.
It's been a while.
When you say diabolical, you mean they just lie to someone on Survivor, or what's the unique feature here?
It's not the just lying to people. We see people lie constantly on Survivor, but Victoria, to me, is almost like, for the Big Brother fans, like Will Kirby-esque in the confessionals about, like, being gleeful about screwing people over. Dom's having a... Dom can't even contain how insane that comparison is.
Yeah, the sheer absurdity of your comparison launched some kind of coughing fit, stroke, not quite sure what episode, not quite sure what was going on there. But yeah, I really am not seeing where you're coming from on this one. So,
I know, just the intent is what I'm getting at. I'm not saying the delivery or the execution is the same. It just seems like it's been a while since we've seen anyone really as like almost eager, it seems like, to blindside people as it looks like Victoria is at this point.
She seems to have a fairly like measured affect to me. Are you channeling Lauren Rimmer here? Do you just not trust a redhead?
I forgot all about that, but that is very funny. No, and I'm not channeling Lauren, and I do, in case it's unclear, like Victoria.
Yeah, I think we should all be channeling Lauren Rimmer more often, for the record. But I don't see the malice, the glint in the eye that you seem to see in Victoria. So I think she came up with a great idea. He executed it very methodically, very well. Definitely deserves all the applause that she's getting from the episode, or from the audience for this episode, as far as I can tell. But you have taken this to a whole new level here.
And by the way, the answer is Jordan Schubel, I think, for most recent player of this kind of affect.
Well, that's not canon, Colin. So let's keep things in track.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's get into how all of this kind of goes sideways for Aubrey here, as this blue team is going to end up going to this is now the current blue team, made up mostly of original yellow team people, who are going to lose this challenge after an incredible comeback on the 3D pyramid puzzle by the Lesu tribe, who it looked like were going to get smoked yet again. And we are going to see Aubrey end up, not breaking news to anyone listening to this podcast, but obviously things not going to go Aubrey's way here. And I'm wondering how much you thought of this setup was just blatant misdirection. I'm going to have the same question when we get to the second tribal council as well. And I guess what I'm getting at this first time around is, setting aside the idea of having her idol and her extra vote that we'll get to shortly, how cooked did you feel Aubrey's goose was as soon as this was her tribe draw?
That goose was a marked man and or woman. It just felt like
Wendy couldn't set it free.
Sadly not. But yeah, it just the immediate focus on Aubrey that never really relaxed at all. It just felt like this was the beginning of the end, and we were seeing just this car crash in slow motion.
Right.
And as you got further on in the scene, and we had only heard from Aubrey. I don't think we heard anything from Gavin. We had one token thing from Eric, I believe. It's like, I'm not sure what the other option even was, really. Like, maybe it is truly that straightforward, and Aubrey was overthinking it, and we were just going to see Wendy go home in the most predictable tribal council of all time, or maybe, you know, it was still equally predictable for us, but not for her, and it got flipped around, and of course, all of the confessionals that she gave about, this seems far too easy, things are far too simple right now, things are going so well, were going to be used against her. And like I'm sure she knew the moment she saw that second Aubrey vote exactly what her edit would look like on this episode.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, we saw her on the edge of extinction describe it as like a JT style embarrassment. And I think that is a pretty apt parallel. Obviously JT in Game Changers going out under very similar circumstances. But I think Aubrey's reaction to having those votes come in and being so shocked, and then before she even gets up and gives her torch to Jeff, she says to the whole tribe, wow, you guys are incredible players. I can't believe that this is happening to me right now. Dom, as someone who spent the bulk of this preseason and the months leading up to it, like as soon as the cast was released, really railing against the idea of returning players playing against newbies on the grounds that the returning players for the last 15 years or however long that's been a concept have just been able to run over pretty much any newbies thrown in front of them. Are we potentially at the point now where newbie casting has evolved so much since like 2011 that it may almost go the other way and these more game savvy newbies may be not overestimating the extent to which people like Aubrey or Joe are threats, but defaulting at least to the position of I should be concerned about them instead of I should view them as my best friend and a huge asset.
There's just no pleasing some people, is there?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying, is I think we may have been way off here.
Look, even for the Aubrey fans, it sucks that it had to be her who was on the receiving end of this and who ends up being maybe the totemic example now. But it is very refreshing to see returning players not just automatically be put on a pedestal the way that they have been so many times prior to this. And yeah, I think this is a worse result than a player of Aubrey's caliber can expect, and it's to the newbie's credit that they were able to snow her like this. Because with Russell Swan, which is, as far as I can remember, the only example before this of one of these returning players going out pretty much, other than Russell Hans, who is his own unique case in so many ways.
He's done it twice, actually, so not unique. He's gone out pre-merge amongst newbies twice now.
Yeah, he's the Sandra of getting voted out pre-merge. but with Russell Swan, it's like, okay, no one had any high expectations for him to begin with, and also he's on a tribe with Malcolm and Denise, who were always going to be the last two standing, and then also it still took the first three votes on a doomed Matt Singh tribe to trim the fat before Russell himself was taken out. Whereas here, the very first vote that Aubrey goes to, she meets her demise, and that really sends a bold statement about the power dynamic, I guess, between new players and returning players in Survivor in 2019.
Right. I don't fact check me on this, but I believe it may be the case that the only returning players to be mixed in with newbies and not survive at least three votes are now Russell Hans and Aubrey Bracco, which is a crazy pairing.
Yeah, it really is.
Yeah. And I would probably chalk this up to, much like in Game Changers, it really seemed like Aubrey's reputation just so vastly preceded her here, and to maybe even a more exaggerated extent than in Game Changers, where at least there were some other people that had that kind of big status within the community as tough players and big-time gamers. But this was a situation where, other than Joe, who is mostly known for challenges, and then Kelly Wentworth and David, who to this point have not made the finals and were big fan favorites, but weren't, known for like running the entire show the whole time necessarily, it really did seem like Aubrey was in this kind of modern cast virtually never going to have a real chance to play here, as far as I can tell.
My question now is, what do you think this does to her Survivor legacy and reputation?
Well, to me, it seems like she's still going to technically be out there until day 37 at least again.
Okay, so we can't close the book just yet, but assuming we can, you know, if we look ahead into the future, what do you think the verdict is going to be?
So I think Aubrey is potentially a great illustration of something I've said about the aforementioned Russell Hans many times, most recently when he went to Australia, and once again, his team took him out the very first chance they had. I said about Russell, I hope he has finally learned there is nowhere in the world he can go and succeed at Survivor. And I think Aubrey is a classic case now of once with very few exceptions, like Suri is like the only exception I can think of. Once your kind of legacy in the Survivor world gets too big, you will just not be allowed to compete anymore on any future seasons. And I think many people are at that point. I think Sandra is done being allowed to compete on seasons of Survivor, for instance.
How much of this is going to depend on the fate of the other returning players on this season? So it seems like Kelly is in a decent spot right now. David somehow is flying under the radar again, which is absurd to me. And Joe is always going to be in the spotlight, and people will try to cut his run short, but he might not give them that many chances to do it. So we could be looking at least a mid-game, if not an end-game, where we know just by the format of the show in this season that Joey has to be there till the very end, and then at least one of Kelly and David is poised to make a deep run. So if that happens, like let's say David gets cut of Final Four again, or Kelly gets cut of Final Four again, or we get a Parvati in Heroes versus Villains kind of scenario where it's clear that returning players can at least make a deep run and succeed by some metric. It just didn't work out for Aubrey. Will that make her look worse in retrospect then?
I think it probably will if the rest of the returning players on this season end up putting in much kind of more respectable bids by comparison, I would say, and kind of do something to disprove the idea that every returnee just has a target the size of Texas on their back and there's nothing they can do to overcome it. But to kind of go back to something I brought up, not preseason, because we didn't even do a preseason podcast for this time around, but after the premiere, I remember saying it just seemed so crazy to me to see Aubrey Bracco out there put into a cast with so many new players. And I think that's essentially what it has come down to for her on this season after the first, I guess, five episodes ended up playing out, where the legacy of Aubrey Bracco was all anyone on the cast needed to see or hear from her this entire season to decide, I am not interested in letting her go far.
It's so hard to speculate about this kind of thing, especially when, because of Edge of Extinction, part of this story has yet to be written or concluded. But do you imagine she's going to regret going back for this third season?
Yes, would be my honest answer. What do you think?
It's so hard to give an answer to that, right? Because if you don't accept that call, you're always going to wonder, what if? Even if you know in your heart of hearts, in the cold light of day, that you're probably not going to win. You're probably going to have a result that will disappoint you if you even get to play, which, as we saw in Game Changers, is not a guarantee. Then it's so hard to turn that down. So
right,
it's the kind of thing. It's the kind of thing where you know you probably are going to regret it, but you're going to regret not going more. So the moment you get the call, it's the best and the worst thing that happened to you.
No, I agree with that. That the idea of turning it down could easily haunt you forever if you end up like watching that season and feeling like it would have been a good spot. But in terms of Aubrey being honest with herself a year from now about whether or not she's glad she went back on Survivor, given how it played out, I think the answer is going to be no.
And thinking back to all of the things she said coming out of Ko Rong about what the Survivor experience did to her life and about how much it just took over and corrupted things for a good length of time, then signing up to that again when you know that it's going to define things the same way for another few months, if not a year or more, it's like she knows better than anyone what she's signing up for, and so for it to play out in the worst way possible basically is got to be really, really tough to deal with.
So to go back to the JT comparison that she made herself, I would suspect JT was not thrilled that he went back for Game Changers after seeing how that one went for him. And it may honestly be, in JT's case, close to the point where if there were no prize money on Survivor, he would have rather just not ever done Survivor based on the way his last two seasons ended up going for him. And I could potentially see that now being the case with Aubrey other than the 100,000 she got for second place, I could see her having, I don't want to say like a ton of regrets about Survivor, but questioning years from now if it was necessarily the smartest or healthiest thing to do to spend close to a year out of a 3-year span constantly playing Survivor.
Yeah, it's, with JT, I know Sandra has said that JT just didn't find Game Changers fun, which is understandable given everything that went down there. In Aubrey's case, on the way out, we saw her tip her cap to the people who voted her out because it's game recognizing game. So I wonder if it's more comforting to feel like you got to play in a sense, but then got outplayed versus you never even had a chance in the first place. You just wasted your time with a front row seat to other people playing the game for you.
Right. And to be clear, I am very nervous now that it comes across like me speaking for Aubrey, and so, like, I have no idea how Aubrey herself does in fact feel about this. I just, my speculation would be at the, based on what we've seen so far, that it's going to be overwhelming disappointment with how this third attempt has ended up going. And like, to I remember when we talked to James Lim after Ghost Island ended up airing, he obviously ran into a rough situation himself and ended up leaving post-swap, but pre-merge, and still was able to take away a ton just from playing Survivor the one time, and he very much appreciated the experience. And it's totally possible that Aubrey grew a ton as a person from this and absolutely has zero regrets. That is completely within the realm of possibility as far as I am concerned. But I remember asking James, if you had gone out there and had the Jacob Derwin experience, would that have been worth it for you? And he said, honestly, no. And I feel like Aubrey has essentially gone out there and had the Jacob Derwin experience for a third time player, aka the JT experience, as she put it herself.
Right. And it's gonna feel so different as well when you start on a high. You come out of your first season with a ton of people saying that you were the rightful winner after having played a great game, and then your second time you don't get to play, and then your third time you see her in this episode saying she hasn't got to play yet. No one wants to play the game. It's very Sierra Easton-esque, and then it turns out they are playing the game, just not with her, and she gets shut out once again. So to have that experience not just happen at all, but to happen on that trajectory, has got to make things even worse.
What do you think about her not playing her idol? I know one of your go-to lines is, hey, if you're getting voted out this early with an idol in your pocket, you were pretty screwed going forward no matter what. But obviously, in this particular spot with the merge so close, and such a small tribe and an extra vote that could potentially change everything if she just makes it through another round, do you take any kind of issue with Aubrey playing it risky here?
I don't take an issue with it as a concept, because it depends so heavily on your reads on them in real time. And I think if whatever trust you have with them is already going to be quite tenuous, and it is potentially ruined by you playing the idol and demonstrating your suspicion of them when you don't need to necessarily.
And demonstrating that you didn't tell them about this idol you have.
Yeah, exactly. I don't think there's a good choice there. Obviously, it's easy to look at this and say she made a wrong choice, but if they were gunning for her, she really just had no friends anywhere and was unlikely to pick up any more. I think she may have just been doomed, and there's not much she could have done. That said, the optics of it suggests if you could go back in time and give yourself some advice, just play that damn idol and buy yourself three more days.
I believe she is the only person since James Clement, still unclear on how to pronounce his last name, to be voted out with two advantages unused in their bag. Although I tweeted asking if anyone else qualified for that, and apparently, Dom, Lauren Rimmer, when she was voted out, had like an extra vote and half an idol. I have no memory of half an idol ever being a thing other than Scott Pollard and whoever it was, Ty.
So this was Dr. Mike, who I wish we could all forget a little bit sooner here, had, I think, half of an idol, and then there was some big show at Tribal about him throwing something in the fire. I've done my best to expunge all of that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
How do you feel about James Clements?
So what was I about to say about Aubrey?
Not feeling great, not even acknowledging that.
No, I like James Clements. That's you're inverting it. That's strong. That's always going to get a sympathy laugh. The correct pluralization. But Aubrey, the one thing I did think was at least potentially worthwhile if she did get bad vibes. And to clarify, I am 100% with you, not only in Aubrey's spot, but also later on for both Lauren and Wentworth with their idols at that second vote. It is 100% read dependent. But if you do want to go this route, I think having that extra vote does make it a lot more appealing if you feel like you could somehow get the right person out, where then on this new team of four, you would feel good about using this extra vote to pull in one of the other three people. And now suddenly you have a majority on this group of four.
it's so weird to think that a player like her could go under the radar, especially given her treatment last season and her treatment for the first part of this season. But if you do get to that merge and Kelly, David, and Joe are all still around, and there's this shifting political dynamic and no one is quite sure what's going on, then yeah, maybe Aubrey ends up as like the RC or the Eliza, where everyone can just easily agree on voting her out. But then maybe she can also just slide under the radar herself and find some new thing that's about to form that she can move into and maybe take control of.
Yeah, I mean, I just can't help but wonder how different this could have potentially been if, in some hypothetical universe, all of the returnees were just playing as first-timers themselves. I don't know if Aubrey is necessarily standing out from the crowd and leaving in this spot like that.
Do you think she leaves if her tribe has to go to tribal pre-swap? So if it's the bigger, I guess it would be Manu tribe?
Well, that would require Joe losing an immunity challenge and is thus a purely hypothetical exercise. But yeah, I mean, based on how this vote went and the makeup of the people deciding that that would be the right direction to go, namely Victoria, Eric, and Gavin, it really seems like Aubrey had that original yellow team, had to go to a vote, would have really had her back up against the wall. Like, it seems like everything we saw from that original yellow team was, we got to get at the returnees.
The first, and to this point, still one of the few things we've heard from Eric was, I want Aubrey out of this game. And he found his shot to do that, and he took it. Do you think it is a no-brainer for all of them to vote out Aubrey, or is there some like contrarian argument for one of them to want to keep her around?
If you feel like it's going to be a clean look, I definitely can't argue with it. If you're really concerned that she has an idol, maybe that's more of an issue. But with particularly someone like Wendy there as the random person from the other tribe, I would not be super worried about Wendy turning things around on me later, whereas with Aubrey, there never really seems like a bad time to take Aubrey out of a game of Survivor, especially when everyone else is a first-time player.
Wendy is a little erratic and maybe bad for business, but she's someone who you know the other tribe cannot stand, and the feeling is mutual. She can't really go back to them, and she seems fairly pliable, like you can get her to follow along with your plan, even if maybe she'll spill the details about what that plan is. So she seems like the perfect person to have around, whereas Aubrey, especially for someone like Eric, who, like, if Aubrey has any designs on the end game, it's probably not going to involve him.
Right.
Like, I think it is an absolute no-brainer, not just to take her out here, excuse me, but to want her out of the game from a very early point. And to Eric's credit, we saw him say that again in the very first episode.
Right. And I feel like that's essentially the story of Aubrey's whole season. You know, assuming she doesn't end up coming back from the edge of extinction and like.
Yeah, I really want all of this to not age well at all. And yeah, for us to be praising Aubrey's incredibly unlikely journey to the title in a few weeks' time. But this is going to throw a spanner in the works with all of that.
Yeah, I hope we just did 15 minutes on how Aubrey's legacy has been destroyed and she's going to regret having gone back as she goes on to win like 2 months from now.
We can only hope.
There is nothing I want more, frankly, than to be able to spend an entire season talking about how Aubrey is getting the winner edit. But I don't know if this is going to be...
Well, and not just as someone who formerly, and maybe still does, because we don't use video anymore, would wear a Team Aubrey shirt during some recordings, but just because the hilarity of that concept is too much to get over.
I still have and wear my Team Aubrey shirt.
Mine is still lying in a basement somewhere in Washington, D.C., and puzzling whoever found it in that Airbnb. But anyway.
Yeah. All right. So there goes Aubrey, at least for now, and hoping for the best, of course, for Aubrey out on Edge of Extinction. I think it would be fun to have Aubrey be the person who ends up returning, right?
Yeah. How likely do you think that is? Because I know people are penciling in Chris as that prohibitive favorite, and certainly Keith is assuming that. He's already gleeful about the idea of taking Chris down a few notches. But I wonder if Aubrey, who is no slouch in challenges herself, and who just has that experience of having played more of them, versus Chris, who was voted out early enough that he's played, I think, like, if you're counting rewards as well, he may have played 4 lifetime Survivor challenges in his career, whereas Aubrey is in, what, like, I don't know what it would even be, but certainly in like the 30s or 40s at this point,
yeah,
I imagine.
Somewhere in there.
Yeah, so just that experience edge alone has to count for a ton.
I would agree with that. I she's got to be among the favorites just because I do not see Reem winning whatever it is. I'd be pretty surprised by Keith winning whatever it is. And Chris, it looks like, is going to get hit with whatever the disadvantage is that Keith found. So my top two contenders right now would be Aubrey and Rick, although Wendy would be another exciting option, who I had forgotten was even going to be competing in this.
I would love Wendy to just, like, rise from the dead and go on some, like, vengeance tour against everyone who's wronged her in the game. But
actually, I'm going to take that back. I do not want Wendy back in the game. I think Wendy would be good on Edge of Extinction with Reem, with Keith, causing a bunch of drama there, whereas I would very much prefer to see certainly Rick or Aubrey and potentially one of the others back in the game, just because with the merge coming around and a group of whatever it is, 11 or 12 other people now, essentially all of whom I am really excited to see play in an individual setting, because I think every single person in this cast has potential to really shake the game up. I do not know if I want Wendy being the one getting thrown back in there and opening the door for everything comes down to who can get this landmine Wendy on their side determining this whole season versus like a real player, frankly, like Rick or Aubrey.
It does scare me a little bit that the most likely outcome of Chris winning is also maybe the most boring outcome.
For sure.
Because in everything you've said there, Keith maybe would be an interesting wild card. Reem just interacting with other human beings is always a delight. As you say, Rick and Aubrey would be really fun game pieces to see how they could move around on the board. I'm not sure what Chris is offering in any of those directions.
Yeah, I would... As on paper, it seems like Chris would be the front runner. I will acknowledge that. Just not only because of the disadvantage it seems like Keith is going to throw on him, because of what you're saying, just the lack of kind of just build up for Chris really makes me feel like, who's that excited about Chris coming back into the game, and thus what's the real likelihood of that?
Well, given that we can't have nice things, the likelihood is very high indeed.
And the weird thing is, and this is something that unfortunately hasn't come up about Chris, because I didn't find out about this until the week he was voted out, and then I believe that was the week we didn't end up getting to do a podcast. Chris is a, as far as I can tell, like, diehard Survivor super fan, and one of the things that every season I always try to ask Josh Wigler is, when you were out there on location interviewing these new players, who among them, whomst among them, recognized you? And the answer is this season, and the reason I ask that is because it seems like the Wiglets or the Wigglers Wombats, who always recognize Josh, tend to do really well on Survivor. And the people this season were Gavin and Eric, and he said both of them knew who he was but weren't like hardcore fans. And then Chris, who was an Evolution of Strategy listener, and if you listen back to the audio of when he first meets Josh, he walks in going, wiggle, 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 and clearly knows exactly who he is and knows all the inside jokes and is excited to meet him. And when I found out that information, my response was, all right, I'm all in on Chris, baby. And then he was voted out like 2 days later. But point is, I feel like we were honestly robbed of what could have been a whole different side of Chris if he had been in there with more room to play.
Yeah, it's possible too that I'm not giving Chris nearly enough credit because, again, personality wise he's fairly low-key, fairly understated, and the fact that he was even in the mix to be voted out at all seemed baffling, right? Because guys like Chris are exactly the type who always make it to the merge without question unless something goes horribly, horribly wrong. And so if he is working with that fandom too, maybe it's just that just not being loud enough that hurts him. But also just the editing this season, I think, has slipped back or regressed, certainly in the main part of the game at least, to some of those previous seasons where they're going by this paint-by-numbers formula where unless you are relevant to the exact thing that's happening right now, or if we need to fit you in somewhere and this is just a way to force you in, then you're not going to get a sliver of screen time. So a guy like Chris who doesn't live up to his potential and also does not do a good job of conveying that potential is never going to get a word in edgeways.
Right, and it's going to be an uphill battle for pretty much anyone on a season where we essentially have four tribes between the three that we have split into and everyone over on Edge of Extinction, coupled with having four returnees who are going to probably have an edge in getting some screen time, you really have to not even work as a newbie, but find yourself in the right situation as a newbie to be a prominent storyline just in any circumstance under those kind of conditions. And one thing I think is kind of going maybe overlooked is the wrong word, because people are certainly noticing that half the people in the game haven't been to any of these votes up until about an hour before the merge rolls around. But in terms of just the storytelling, that is a lot for the editors to contend with when it is the same group of people going to every single vote, and conversely, the same 5 to 8 people who the inner workings aren't really relevant right now, when there's so much more going on that we need to get to in these 42 minutes. And when that is the dynamic, I think conventional kind of editing theories, to put it in kind of weird terminology, almost need to go out the door when there is so little opportunity for literally half the cast to get screen time.
But we have examples of almost this exact situation being done much better. So you think back to Philippines, where, again, you have three tribes, and it's from three tribes from the start there, so it's a little bit different, but three tribes and returning players, and one tribe just going to tribal over and over again, and so you need excuses to check in with the other tribes, and yeah, they still did a good job of fleshing out, certainly Tan Dang, and I know at the time we flagged up that Calabao seemed like it was kind of caught in the middle in this uneasy position where they feel like the tribe that you have to check in with. But even despite that, that was a very fun season to watch. It felt like most characters there, with the exception of like Artis or Carter, who and
how dare you?
You are, or Cartis, if you want to ship them, I suppose. You understood that some people had to fall by the wayside. But here it feels like there are just entire swathes of the cast that we just never get to hear from. So like Gavin and Eric seem like they're finding their voice this episode, but Aurora, let's say, or Julie and Julia and so many others just have disappeared from the season before it even began.
Right. And I am hoping that when this merge rolls around, that's going to get smashed wide open. But I feel like, I guess the way to put it is, it seems like people are being a little too hard on the editors, as far as I would be concerned, about the imbalance with the edit, when I would really feel like one would have a hard time drawing up tougher circumstances under which to make half the cast visible.
Fair enough.
Yeah. All right. So let's get, I guess, this back episode is a couple of challenges, and then frankly, a lot of trying to lead us down the path of this is going to end up going to rocks, as we see two tribes going to one tribal council together, and they are at least on paper split 4-4. I guess the place to start here, Dom, is what was your take on seeing this twist back in play that we first saw in Game Changers, actually at that live know-it-alls episode? Got to watch Malcolm get voted out in heartbreaking fashion in a room of like 300 people. What did you think of seeing this back?
Yeah, that was fantastic. So this was going to have a very high bar to live up to. But I know at the time we both had quite conflicted feelings about whether that twist was a good idea. And even if it didn't seem like a good idea then, could it be implemented in a better way in the future? And I still can't remember where we ultimately came down on that. My own feelings have kind of changed and melded over time. I think in this case, it didn't really live up to its potential. So in theory, it's fun to see like two sides going to war and playing chicken with the idea of rocks and who's going to break first, and with each side knowing that that's in place, like who do you vote for to make that most likely? It's a fun thing for us to talk about in these episodes, but it's not really a fun thing to watch. It's not something that can be great TV in the same way. And so, especially when Wendy had just been the go-to decoy or the person that we all assumed was going to get voted out for the past few weeks, for this twist to be wasted essentially on her felt like it just turned into a busted flush.
So to me, I actually kind of liked the way that this played out. And I know it's going to sound like I'm just being super hard on Wendy and like I'm thrilled she's out of the game. And it's not that. To me, it's more the reaction to what happened to Malcolm, and I think it was understandable, seemed to be that when you implement this kind of twist, that sort of thing is going to happen a huge percentage of the time, especially if it is not an even distribution of loyalty, where a huge target from one side who would probably never leave under normal circumstances ends up just having horrible timing on a twist and getting totally killed the way we saw happen to Malcolm. I do like that we now have, for the historical record, kind of a counterexample, almost the complete opposite, as far as I could tell, of everyone getting together and collectively realizing, even though we are two separate tribes and half of us haven't played with the others before, none of us are really that interested in risking our games for this one kind of outsider. And I feel like Wendy is the perfect counterexample to the Malcolm boot in terms of the alternate timelines that this kind of twist can take. And with that in mind, and with also in mind the idea of production just from time to time, every couple of years, throwing this twist in just to see what happens, I don't have an issue with this. I feel like this is something I am totally cool with coming back into play. I would have no complaints if this continues to be a once every four-ish seasons kind of deal.
I can co-sign all of that. It's just that, and maybe again, this is anchored by just how incredibly insane that Malcolm tribal was, and the whole experience of watching that in that room with all those people. But this just, like, we knew Wendy was either going to be going out pre-merge in likely a pretty boring vote, or was going to get dragged to the end and be a zero vote finalist, and nothing in between really even seemed plausible. So it's kind of like, we wanted something other than those two outcomes, and then the monkey's paw twitched. We kind of got that, but then not really. So I don't know. It just felt like we lost Wendy, but we didn't really lose her in a much more interesting way. And so many other cool things could have happened here. Like an idol gets wasted, or someone gets taken out with an idol, or we do go to rocks again, or to avoid going to rocks. One person tries to flip, but then maybe we get the Will Wall thing where two people flip at the same time and it cancels each other out, so we do go to rocks. It's just, there were so many fun possibilities, and I don't know if you had to rank them, how high this would come up on that list.
I agree with that this is not one of the most exciting outcomes for this twist being implemented in the dark, but in terms of most exciting ways to lose Wendy, I would say this is high up there. Because in any other timeline, it's just going to be Wendy has obviously rubbed enough people the wrong way and her number is finally called. And it's just going to be the build up to that is just going to be nonsense trying to lead us down a different path.
Yeah, I really can't take issue with that.
All right. One thing to flag up from a couple of the challenges this episode, Dom, I know I have bored you to death by flagging up constantly in our Fiji podcast, which incidentally people can find over at patreon.com/Dom and Colin. Weekly bonus episodes that are currently covering Fiji. I have become obsessed with noticing who is left-handed and who is not. My mind was blown this episode when two of the challenges highlighted a secret lefty on this season. Not only on this season, I had never noticed Joe Anglim is left-handed, and it blew my mind. This was the first time I noticed it. I know that's an insane point to make, but I just wanted it on the record because that was a big talking point in our last Fiji episode, and I got a couple tweets, thankfully, from some loyal listeners who also noticed it. Joe, secret lefty, so note that for your scorecards.
Wait, are you a lefty? This feels like the kind of thing that I should know about you, but here we are.
I am not a lefty. It just, for whatever reason, really just stand... so...
As a fan of knowledge, this stuck out to you.
It's just, it seems like, obviously I miss it all the time. I missed it with Joe for a long time, but when I notice it, I can't stop noticing it, that someone is left-handed. And like, for instance, there is nothing more obvious than when someone is golfing left-handed. Like you see Phil Mickelson, and it's impossible to miss that he is not lined up from the same side as every other golfer you've essentially ever seen. And furthermore, like watching a left-handed quarterback throw a football is the ugliest thing you've ever seen in your life when you've spent the whole time watching right-handed people. And thankfully, I don't believe there are any lefties in the NFL right now. I think it's been a while, like Mike Vick might have been the last left-handed quarterback, but it is really the contrast is startling, I guess. And for whatever reason, it always seems interesting to me noticing who is left-handed. And Joe just blew my mind. That is not something I had seen before. And then like three of the four challenges this episode had him doing a bunch of left-handed shit. So I thought it was at least worth bringing up, but now you're making me regret it.
See, I never remember conversations that we have on the podcast, and it continues to baffle me how you can just casually drop a reference to something that someone we interviewed said 6 years ago. But I feel like we had this exact conversation at least once on one of Joe's previous seasons.
Maybe we did. Listen, as far as Joe's previous seasons are concerned, you're 100% right. I don't remember anything from Worlds Apart, and I remember very little of the details of Joe's game in particular in Cambodia. But like when I was referencing the James Lim interview, that was like 8 months ago. It wasn't, and the left-handed conversation was literally last week on the Fiji podcast.
Well, hold on. Don't sell yourself short, because like we interviewed Yaman at least five, maybe closer to 6 years ago at this point, and you just dropped in a quote from that as if it was nothing.
Well, it's because Fred, the quote it was about, we were talking about, we just hit the merge in Fiji where they did the fake full merge and then split everyone into two groups of five, and one small group had to go to that tribal council, and Yao's team was loaded with his allies, and I remember his answer because, I mean, quite frankly, it stood out to me as just like so fundamentally the wrong idea that we asked, did you consider throwing this challenge and making sure that your allies on the other group of five were safe and you could pick off someone from within your group of five along with Earl and Cassandra, whoever else was on his team. And his answer was, I would never consider throwing an immunity challenge. And that stuck with me for years because that is such a bad philosophy.
Okay, the right answer there is that empathy is your superpower too, and you're just a very good listener, Colin. You take in things that people say.
I think I have a decent but highly selective memory.
Sure, which is not the worst thing to have, frankly.
Sure. So enough left-handedness for this podcast. Dom, I guess let's get into before this tribal council quickly. Kelly Wentworth finds yet another hidden immunity idol, her third of her career. Any major takeaways from that? Are you excited to have Wentworth back in the idol game?
I am. Even though it had a certain inevitability to it, of course she was going to find one, right? I was excited for her, although she came under attack for firing some shots at David this episode. I know that comment about David's basically a woman, he sucks in these challenges, did not go over well on Twitter, certainly. It's fine. Defend your girl, Colin. Let's go.
When I rewatched this episode, the first time I heard that confessional, I had a similar thought. I thought, wow, that it seems like a pretty unwoke thing for Wentworth to say. And then I rewound it and I watched it again to listen to her exact words. And as far as I could tell, she was saying, David, in the challenges, acts as a female. It is in challenge terms, the same as if we had three women and War Dog. And she's not, I don't think, extrapolating anything further beyond just who David can match up against in challenges.
Right, but I think the people who didn't like that comment interpreted it in the same way, and that's what they were reacting to.
What did they react? They don't like that men are generally stronger than women? Like, that's a controversial statement?
Well, you're now canceled too, Colin. I'm sorry.
Oh, my God.
It's just like, if someone else had said, the women are weaker in the challenges, and David's basically a woman, it feels like Kelly, among others, would be the first to like push back against that. So it's just weird to hear that sentiment coming out of her mouth, is all.
Oh, I mean, if that's War Dog giving that confessional, War Dog is 100% canceled.
I mean, War Dog has been canceled already several times, but yes, he would be canceled again.
Right. So there is Wentworth with yet another idol, although we end up seeing Dom, despite the way things went, Wentworth for her last time with the Andrew Savage idol, where she kept it completely to herself and was able to use the element of surprise to maximum effect, negate 9 votes and take out the dream target. Under these circumstances, we end up seeing Wentworth tell Lauren pretty quickly thereafter, hey, I just found the idol. And now obviously these are much different circumstances where this vote is going to be potentially total chaos, and Lauren is someone you definitely need looped into your priorities if she's someone you're hoping to continue having as your closest ally at the end of the night, and hopefully for a long time going forward. And thankfully for Kelly, Lauren very quickly says to her, hey, by the way, I have one too, and everything's great. They both get to sit on them and feel even better about their bond going forward. But it did at least surprise me, just given her history, that Wentworth was so forthcoming about her idol. Did you think anything one way or the other about that?
The pun master in you really wants to say that things went worth for her last time, but they didn't. It's really hard to fault the way that she used both of those idols in Cambodia. So it feels like that's a high thing to live up to. But the ceiling is potentially very high, right? Because she and Lauren both have them. Lauren trusts her implicitly. They don't need to spread that beyond the two of them. So there's no need to like leak it to Wardog and whoever else might end up getting involved with them. So those are weapons that they can hold until the time is right and then unleash them on an unsuspecting opposing alliance. So like that might be the idol find that really allows them to make a deep run together. And so like it would not shock me if we see a final three containing Lauren and Wentworth and a timely idol play or two is what allows them to really make it there.
I agree. It seems to me like Lauren is really being set up to be like the spiritual successor to Kelly Wentworth, right? Where I think it's in the premiere, we get a confessional from her talking about how crazy it is that her favorites are Parvati and Kelly Wentworth, and now she's on a tribe with Wentworth, and now a few episodes later, she and Wentworth are finding idols together and heading into a merge into potentially pretty strong situation. It really seems like that is a duo to be on the lookout for, and it seems like Lauren in particular is getting out of the newbies some of the strongest stuff along those lines. But let's get into this vote here, and obviously,
well, just quickly, do you think there's a chance that Lauren is the one who has to end up slaying her hero? Because if she's the only one who knows about Kelly's idol, she knows that there's a level of urgency to taking her out if that's what you want to do, so she might have to be the one to initiate that blindside if and when it ends up happening.
I definitely would say that is in the realm of possibility, and I would further say at this point I would suspect Lauren turning on Wentworth would be more likely than vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but I could also see that for sure going the other way if Wentworth gets vibes.
Thanks for taking a stance, Colin.
You're really committed to that. Yeah, I hate it when people quote me later on about things I get wrong. So,
the beauty of this is whatever ends up happening, we can quote you as having said that. Like either it happened or it didn't happen. You know, take your pick.
I really had all the bases covered. We can say that much for sure. When we end up, Dom, in this 4-on-4 situation, what is the move? Do you have to get your whole side on board to, or at least gauge who is on board to potentially go to Rocks? And what's the plan here when you are one of these groups of four in terms of how to approach this initial vote and then potential kind of like pivot moves once you see how that goes?
It would be more interesting in a way if Wendy was replaced by just like a neutral third party. But as it is, For Kelly and David and that group, it just makes so much sense to pile the votes on Wendy and issue that challenge, throw down the gauntlet to the other tribe to go to Rocks to keep around someone who they've only just met and who seems fairly, you know, erratic or unstable. And they can do that knowing that if you're going to try and get someone to go to Rocks, Wendy might actually be the most likely person to want to do that because she sees herself as being outcast by that tribe initially. So even if normally Wendy would not go to Rocks for anyone, she definitely would now because what has she got to lose, right? So all of these factors combine to suggest just voting for Wendy and seeing what happens. And then that makes it very difficult for the other side to do anything coherent themselves because they know even if they get a tie on the first vote, at least one of them is going to be sorely tempted to switch their vote to Wendy just for self-preservation, if nothing else.
Right. I think that makes a ton of sense if you are this Lesu group. And if I'm one of the people on the Manu tribe, when Wendy is the one of the people on whom I need to be reliant, I don't know how great I'm feeling about that. And I totally understand any of them going into that tribal council feeling like I'm going to do whatever I need to do to come out of this one alive, and whatever that means going forward, so be it. But I am not going to be drawing a rock for Big Wendy when we are this close to the merge, and I have probably so many friends on the other tribe that hasn't had to touch a tribal council yet. You can go ahead and count me out for drawing rocks on behalf of Wendy. And it seems like, at least the way it's presented, Wardog is the one who comes up with that plan as this Lesu group is trying to figure out what the right idea is. He says, look, we just pile on Wendy. They will not draw rocks for Wendy.
But, so between Cowboy coming up with Plan Voodoo and now this one, Wardog, it seems like having a silly nickname is the key to unlocking some like higher strategic genius.
Do you feel like this principle, if this does become a recurring thing we see, this kind of like twist where multiple tribes are going to tribal council at once, this we could end up with like the Wardog principle of targeting the person that the other side is least likely to go to rocks over?
Yeah, I think it's a fairly obvious idea, but it's also why this, it felt like this went worse than it could have gone for the viewers, because from that standpoint, Wendy is such an obvious vote that like we see Victoria say, I don't know if I'm comfortable going to rocks. I might have to flip my vote if it comes down to that, knowing that it won't come down to that, and that not only she but the others as well are not going to risk their lives for Wendy. It means that no one of them actually ends up having to make any hard choices, because there's this understanding among all of them that, yeah, okay, we took our shot and it failed, but we can just vote for Wendy and it's fine, and we can live to see another day.
Right, I agree, and I think this spot, when you really have time to think about it, is going to be pretty straightforward in Wendy leaving a huge percentage of the time. But when you are the editors, and especially when you know how this is going to go, I think your only real mission for the buildup to this vote is sell the audience on the possibility of this going to rocks and show a bunch of people talking about what's going to happen if rocks becomes a realistic situation, who's maybe going to flip, who's not, and really sell just that is the pressing issue and rocks are a real priority, a possibility, and wouldn't that be exciting? It's so rare on Survivor, but tonight could be the night, and we get the confessional from like David Wright leading into the commercial break, like, this is going to be one of the most exciting votes I've ever been a part of. Haven't heard him say that lately, but I think the editors, with that in mind, did a really good job. Like, I will absolutely own that the whole time watching this tribal council, until the second vote started getting read, I still thought it was very possible we could go to rocks, even seeing what Victoria said and seeing Eric not feeling great about the vibes he was getting from everyone else. I definitely did not think it was just going to be a slam dunk Wendy revote.
Here's a question for you. So in the dark, is someone who is playing for their second or even their third time more or less likely to be willing to commit to rocks? Because you could argue that if you're playing for your first time, you're still so caught up in the enormity of it all that you don't fully understand what it means for rocks to end your game like that. Whereas, especially if you're David Wright and you've seen this happen to one of your closest friends and allies in Jess on that season, you've been through it yourself, maybe you're going to be a little bit more gun-shy about ending your second or third and potentially last chance just some like random process.
So I would say on a case by case basis, this will definitely vary from person to person. But in general, I would say a returning player would be pretty substantially more willing to go to rocks than at least the modern newbie casts of a couple of years ago. Although maybe that has really changed over these last few years. Now that it does seem like they're getting a lot more people who are really familiar with the game actually onto the show. But the reason I say that is just going to rocks is a tremendously correct move in a lot of spots that most newbies don't really seem interested in going for. Whereas I just think in general, returning players will know more about the game and recognize how mandatory going to rocks can be in certain situations.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, like for instance, like, maybe this is a bad example because it was half newbies and half returnees, but like, I think a lot of situations like final six should come down to going to rocks, like we saw in Blood versus Water. And obviously that ended up going the returnees' way, and the newbies were willing to draw rocks. But I do think that kind of situation where you can leverage people based on just their sheer unwillingness to go to rocks is going to favor the more experienced and just better players.
Yeah, I haven't thought about it myself, but that all sounds broadly right to me.
All right, well, I'm glad you agree wholeheartedly. Dom, what do we think, I suppose, about losing Wendy? I know I've talked about being okay with her no longer being like potentially a critical player now that this merge is rolling around, but with the Edge of Extinction, do you think we're going to really miss out on Wendy being a main player in the game, or are we still going to get enough of her on the sidelines?
I think most of the people that it was fun to watch Wendy interact with have already been voted out themselves. So to see Wendy join that band of misfits on Edge of Extinction might be the best thing that could happen for the viewers, if not for any one of them.
Yeah, and Wendy and Ream is a real dream team, spelled D-R-E-E-M-T-E-E-M, of course. But yeah, I'm happy to have Wendy with that kind of group on the Edge of Extinction, and I don't think she's going to be someone that the show is going to forget about anytime soon. I know this time, either last podcast or two podcasts ago, I was talking about Wendy being nearly a lock to be like a returning player on Survivor. At that point, thinking she was overwhelmingly likely to be a zero-vote finalist down the line. Come down slightly on that take, I would say, over the last week or so, Dom, but I still think it's at least in the mix. Even if Wendy never gets back into the main game, if she stays on Edge of Extinction the whole time, I would be 0% surprised to see Wendy back on Survivor.
Okay. Do you think that extends to other people too? So could someone make a name for themselves, even if their achievements in the game obviously weren't up to snuff because they got voted out that early, but if they can remain a big character within those unique circumstances, is that going to put them in the mix?
Ream 2.0, baby. Get it going.
Let's do it.
Yeah. Dom, what did you think of just this pre-merge of Edge of Extinction as a whole, now that it is officially in the books?
It wasn't as like catastrophic as it potentially could have been, and the way that some people feared it was going to be. So I guess that's a plus. But there was nothing really to commend it for me. Like, even this episode, which should have been this big memorable moment, just kind of fizzled out. And you had the Aubrey blindside, which I'm a little sad about, but I can recognize as a genuinely great piece of both Survivor gameplay, and it was fine TV, I suppose, as well. So I don't know. I don't have any specific, like, deep complaints, but I'm not leaving this portion of the game really satisfied.
Yeah, it's not the best pre-merge of all time, and it's probably not, like, one of the top 10 pre-merges of all time, but certainly compared to my expectations and having to acknowledge kind of the story that they were forced to work with, where as we talked about earlier in the podcast, just it was the same people going to every single vote, making all the decisions every episode, as half of the players in the game were getting nothing to do in the last 20 minutes of any of these shows. It was such an uphill battle, I would say, for the editors to paint a remotely balanced picture of what was going on for this entire pre-merge. And I would say, between the twist and the way the challenges and votes all fell, I think they completely knocked it out of the park. And it just wasn't ever going to be one of the most thrilling pre-merges of all time based on how things played out. There was nothing they could do. But given the circumstances they were faced with, I think this was a super commendable job so far. And I would overall say I enjoyed this pre-merge, frankly, way more than I was expecting to, although I am hoping that I am able to remember these fond sentiments when the Edge of Extinction eventually does kind of rear its ugly head and really make me second guess why this twist was ever put in place to begin with.
Yeah, let's hope that take and you both age very gracefully.
Uh-huh. So, Dominic, I guess one thing that we kind of skipped over, but I will quickly ask you about, both Wentworth and Lauren end up sitting on their idols. Again, I think this is 100% read dependent in this scenario. I wouldn't have faulted them under certain other circumstances for playing idols here. But I am guessing, based on everyone getting up and talking and all of the votes coming in on Wendy, like they were more or less 100% certain that was how it was going to go. And in that case, obviously no issue with hanging on to those idols.
Right. Well, one question I have is, what was with all the spellings of Lauren's name? Was that like a coordinated, was that a bit, or did they generally miss the boat on that one?
I don't know. I know Lauren will sometimes be spelled with a Y these days or whatever, but yeah, it's a pretty straightforward kind of millennial name. Lauren's got to be among the like top 10 or 20 girl baby names of 1982 to 1995. So that one definitely took me by surprise.
Yeah, on The Bachelor alone, every season there are like 25 different Laurens. So yeah, it's a fairly ubiquitous name. Maybe this is the storyline though. Maybe they all misspell it now, but then when they find themselves on the jury and Lauren is in the finals, they've finally come around. They've acquired that knowledge and they're ready to cast their vote for her properly this time.
One thing I'd never really considered, but like if I was on Survivor, I'm sure I would get voted out pretty quickly, and it probably would be slightly more tilting if everyone put two L's in my name as they were spelling it. I'd never thought about that. But yeah, that would be kind of a fuck you on the way out.
Two L's, two N's, you could put a K in there instead of a C. There are lots of ways you could mangle that if you're so inclined.
You have a hard name to misspell, but it would be great if like half the tribe actually thought your name was Don or something and they've put the entirely wrong name.
A lot of them would do what you do and just put Dominic just to tilt me, which would definitely work, by the way, just in case you ever need that weapon in your arsenal.
Oh, I've got it in my arsenal. Don't worry. So let's quickly, I think, preview just this merge that we have coming up next time. Again, we've seen so little from what the dynamics are on that original yellow team and post-swap yellow team, and so many of the people who are going to be presumably power players going forward are going to have originated on that tribe. But given what the Lesu 4 has overcome at this point, the original blue team of Wentworth, Lauren, Wardog, and David, do you see those four ever really splintering compared to that original comma group that it seems like can't wait to start turning on each other? It seems to me, at least on paper, like this Lesu 4 is the new Matt Singh, as far as I can tell.
I'm sure there will be some moment between, let's say, final 9 and final 7 when they start to turn on their own. Maybe like, let's say, Wardog turns on Kelly, Kelly turns on Wardog, maybe David's name will be uttered for the first time this season. So that alliance contains players who are willing and able to take these shots at each other. But for now, I think they will sit together, if only because they have to, because the perception of them as this big, like, durable unit is going to cause everyone else to team up against them. So the battle lines are going to be drawn fairly early there. Are we officially in the edit zone now?
We can go into the edit zone now, I guess.
Okay.
Well, yeah, as we anticipate the merge, let's do send it into the edit zone. So for anyone averse to that sort of thing, I don't think we have a new edit zone bumper for this season. So here's your warning. Tune out now. Edit zone takes incoming from this point forward as we start looking ahead at the merge. But if you're going to be tuning out, he is on Twitter at DomHRV. I am at Colin Stone. Email the show, domandcolin@gmail.com. Here we are in the edit zone. Sorry, Dom, continue.
Thank you. So where was I?
Wasn't listening. Yeah. Who cares?
I think that goes for most of the audience too. But so my first question to you was going to be, do you think Joe, we've seen Joe this episode say, or be told, do it for Sierra. Will we get a chance to see the eponymous Sierra? Will she be his family visit somewhere down the line here?
It sure seems that way, right? Like, I don't think it was canon on their season together that Joe and Sierra were a thing. In fact, I believe Joe went back, and then wasn't he dating Kelly Wigglesworth after Cambodia?
There,
and then
there was something weird going on there. I don't know what they would call it or what we would call it, but yeah, suffice to say there was an involvement of some kind.
Okay, and so I would guess having Do It for Sierra be subtitled on the screen is going to lead to an eventual explanation as to which Sierra is in question, whom she is. And I don't know how many of the casual fan base, like, if we arrive at the loved one's visit, how many of them, unless Jeff goes out of his way to say it, would recognize Joe's girlfriend Sierra as a two-time Survivor player.
Right. I hope this doesn't turn into another like Wendell with Nicole situation where by the time it's aired, things have already turned sour and it all just looks incredibly awkward in retrospect. But they were meant to be, Colin. They are, you know, they're truly in love and nothing will ever come between them.
I guess so. I mean, I always am amazed by like how many people end up marrying someone from like their hometown and also believe in like the concept of like soulmates or whatever. And it just so happens that the person you were,
right.
You know what I'm saying? And it is kind of weird to think about the idea of like in Joe and Sierra's world. Not to speculate too far into their relationship or whatever, I could see there being some element of like, Survivor is what brought us together. We were on this season together and just didn't even know it at the time. And that's, it's like an even more extreme example of the hometown. It's like there were only 18 of us on this whole season.
It could be an additive thing too. It could be like the Ian Terry principle of this experience has been so transformative and such a fundamental part of my life that only people who have also been through it could really understand it. And so that narrows the pool of, like long-term partner potential, I guess, pretty substantially. And I guess Joe is still going to have the pick of the litter in terms of who he wants to take a shot with. But yeah, that might just be like, it's an incredible bonding experience. And even if we didn't know it at the time, you know, in retrospect, that's what set that spark alight. Do you set sparks alight? What do you do to spark?
I don't know what one does with sparks, but you know, the more I think about it, like I think that is a good point. We see way more couples from Survivor and Big Brother stay together and be happily married for a long, long time than we have ever seen on The Bachelor, which at least allegedly exists like with that outcome as the goal. And I think that kind of almost like shared trauma is certainly one element of particularly the Big Brother couples, a feeling like no one else could possibly understand what going through that is like. And so I certainly don't mean to say that because you were both on Survivor, you can't possibly be a good couple. We've seen it work out a ton of times. It just seems like such a potentially narrow kind of pool from which to be drawing if you're Joe and you feel like those are the only people that could understand what you've been going through. Like, when is the last time Joe got rejected by anyone from, like, if Joe were on one any of the dating apps, it would just be nothing but people swiping right on him.
Right. Here's a question which you have no way of answering, but I'm going to ask you anyway. Have there been any Jeopardy couples? Like, couples who met because in the course of one person's like six game run or something, their opponent who was standing next to them in game two really caught their eye. And, you know, they struck up conversation afterwards and one thing led to another and so on and so forth.
There have definitely been so many, I'm sure, Jeopardy connections made, not necessarily against people that they've played against, but I feel like I recently heard that people who were like in the green room together playing on separate episodes ended up hitting it off. And I'm positive that kind of thing happens all the time in terms of people becoming like trivia teams or study buddies or whatever. And I promise you, Dominic, I will take way the over on 10, maybe not married, but 10 duos of people who met because of Jeopardy and eventually fucked. That played Jeopardy, not just like we're fans of Jeopardy.
All right. Well, if you are for some reason in a position to provide answers there, you have a problem. Just stop stalking people. Get yourself some help. But that is I'm not saying an interesting thing to speculate about. Let's really not actually speculate about it any further. Let's move on to something.
Okay. Yeah.
Else.
Let's move on. I'm very uncomfortable. Listen, this episode, I'm going to just put it out there right now. I'm not sure how thrilled I am with some of my comments about Aubrey's legacy and Joe and Sierra's relationship. We'll see how those things age.
We'll have an official apology segment earmarked for the time next time.
Yeah. All right. So, in other kind of just edit zone terms, who are you looking at as a possible merge boot? Whom are you looking?
I have no idea, honestly.
I don't either. Is Joe too obvious of an answer if he doesn't win the immunity?
Well, given that we expect him to be there to meet Sierra, then yeah.
Oh, and, true. Yeah.
And that is actually a question too. So if we think he's going to make it to the family visit, which usually happens, I guess, final 9 to final 7, somewhere in that range, although it really does jump around a lot these days. How do you think he makes it there? Because he has to be in the main part of the game still. So maybe his alliance takes power and he doesn't actually need to win that many immunities. But when I say his alliance, he doesn't have one yet. So that's going to need to come into existence pretty soon. Or maybe he just does win his way there. They never get a clean shot at him. Or there's one time when they do, but it makes more sense to go after somebody else for some reason. Or Joe finds that re-hidden idol or something. Like, there are lots of ways it could happen, but it feels like it will happen. And so one of those things has to manifest itself.
Yeah, I would guess the most likely outcome is they do it at like final 9 or whatever, and Joe just wins 3 necklaces, is certainly one possibility. But maybe the answer to over under 0.5 votes survived unimmune could be way over. In particular, like if you are this group of 4 from this Lesu tribe, Joe could be a potentially really appealing person to potentially try to bring in, depending on what's going on with the rest of the original Kama people that we frankly haven't gotten to see a ton from. But what we have seen suggests to me that Joe may not be the person they're super eager to try to be working with now post-merge.
And Joe might feel pretty desperate to just get a foot in the door anywhere. So the first team to make like any kind of compelling offer to him is going to have his vote.
Yeah. In terms of other merge boots, who the hell could it even be other than maybe the person who returns from Edge of Extinction?
And they just get like Matt Elrodded?
Yeah.
Yeah, I could see that for sure.
That wouldn't surprise me too much. I mean, I guess like we've seen a little from Eric. I know you haven't been seeing a ton from him, but I feel like we've seen enough of Eric that people would know roughly who he is and understand why he could potentially be a target. Maybe Gavin for similar reasons, although again, we just haven't seen a ton that would lead me to feel like either of them is in imminent danger other than things just radically shifting now that the merge has come, which is totally in play. But I would honestly not be super surprised by, frankly, anyone outside of that Lesu 4.
Yeah, so who do you have in the mix as a possible winner then? Because it feels like that pool of candidates is narrowing pretty fast as well.
So, again, I really think it's being overlooked just how far up against the wall the editors' backs were this season with having to constantly tell the story from the perspective of essentially these same 4 people, this Lesu group of Wentworth, Lauren, David, and Wardog. And because of them getting so much screen time, I feel like they have to be 4 of the people near the top of the board at this point, and none of them would surprise me. I'm certainly nowhere near done chaining any of those 4. But outside of that, it really does, you're right, seem like pretty slim pickings. But because now the merge is coming around, I think we could be poised for that to change pretty quickly now that everyone's going to be going to every vote.
What do you make of the comments about Wardog in this episode, where we have people saying Wardog is so annoying, he never listens to anyone, he always has to get his way, but then them conceding that actually it is, his way is the right way, and the Wardog does have a point, and he is coming up with the right idea.
And Wardog is a lot like Tony Vlachos, as it is mispronounced on the show. Can't give anyone too hard of a time for that. But yeah, I think
that is a fulsome praise within the Survivor canon, despite what may or may not have been reputed to happen in Game Changers.
Right, that's what I mean. As I think having Wardog being shown kind of erratically, but coming up with the right ideas and then being compared to Tony, to me, could go either way, but I am inclined to believe that they are showing us that there is kind of a method to this madness.
Mm.
Any of these Lesu 4, I would not argue with anyone having as like their number one contender. Just depends on how your taste in edits may vary. But for me, I would say within that group, kind of going on the Nick Wilson principle of last season, it seems like Wentworth and Lauren in particular were shown surviving some narrow escapes during this pre-merge. Their backs were up against the wall and they were able to get their way out of it. And with that in mind, I would say Wentworth and Lauren would probably be my two front runners out of that group.
I would agree with all of that. What do you make of David Wright's chances at this point?
I still am buying David Wright. I feel like he was someone people were talking about getting off to a good start and then slowing down a bit. But it seems to me like pretty difficult to draw up a better situation for David entering this merge here. I feel like if you told him on day one, this is going to be what the political situation is entering the merge on day 15 or 18 or whatever it is now, I think he would snap that off.
Sure. And then the only other person who even registers for me really is Victoria, who I know impressed a lot of people this episode, gameplay wise, but edit wise, where does she stand for you?
So I think Victoria, in case it wasn't clear earlier, I think has been a huge casting home run. And I know she's getting a lot of hype and love as she very much deserves and is bringing something, I think, pretty fresh to the show. And I would be totally here for a Victoria win. And maybe in that timeline, they would absolutely paint her the same way Big Brother painted the aforementioned Will Kirby, of just ruthlessly happy to take anyone out the entire way, as long as it means victory for her, victory for Victoria in the end. But I don't know if I'm buying her as one of the front runners to win. I would honestly say I would have Eric above Victoria, and probably not many other people above Victoria, but I do think actually Eric has stood out these last few weeks. I really in particular loved, we saw Aubrey as they were powwowing this plan to get rid of Wendy, talking about how we're going to forge it in fire tonight and we're going to come back to this camp stronger than ever. And as they're at tribal council and Jeff is grilling them, Eric gives him a line about how we're going to go and forge this vote in fire. And Aubrey like nods confidently. I thought that was really strong. And furthermore, I thought he looked really good kind of leading his team. It seemed like to me, as they were faced with this double tribal council situation, I thought he had a really strong segment there. And I could easily see that also meaning Eric is our merge boot next week. That wouldn't surprise me whatsoever. But in terms of kind of grasping at straws for people from the original comma team to have faith in, I would honestly say Eric would be my number one at this point.
Well, as a Will Kirby fan rather than a, you know where I stand in that debate. I got to stick with my girl Victoria here.
Okay, I can't argue with that.
I really don't get that comparison, but you seem very committed to making it, so I'll ride along with it for the time being.
I'm rolling with that one. Everyone in the audience knows what I'm saying. At least the woke folks who were fans of Big Brother back in the early days, and the other half are the woke folks who have never tuned into Big Brother in their life, and we are just really the idiots who watched the bad seasons. Other winner candidates potentially in the mix here for me. I want to just quickly talk about a couple other people from that original yellow team, just because I feel like if there were ever a season where we could get a winner just go so far under the radar, these would be the exact circumstances under which that kind of thing would happen. And especially during Ko Rong, when Michelle got some certain treatment while she was not going to any tribal councils, and that potentially tipped things a little much, potentially they could be kind of easing off on that. I feel like Gavin, Julie, and Ron have at least popped up from time to time and looked good, but there hasn't been much of an opportunity, frankly, to show us a ton of what's going on with any of them. Are they all dead for you, or do you feel like there's some chance?
They're all dead for me. I don't disagree with your point about this might be a good time for an under-the-radar winner, but there's under-the-radar, and then there's half of the contestants on the season who, many of whom have vanished entirely, and the others have, as you say, popped up from time to time, but not when. So with Michelle, our thing was always, there's no reason for her to be getting anything right now. We're getting her constantly, and the stuff that she's getting is very winner-esque, and I don't really think that any of those things are true for the Gavins and the Rons of the world, or the Erics, I suppose.
Right. In fairness, Michelle came on the heels of Natalie Anderson, Mike Holloway, and Jeremy Collins, where it was very similar treatment, and just the pattern was never deviated from.
Well, Natalie Anderson was very interesting case, I thought. But yeah, I see your larger point.
Right. Whereas we are now in a completely different world of Survivor editing, in a much better world of Survivor editing. And actually, Dom, in thinking about just these original yellow people that potentially have some equity, we talked earlier about Joe's chances of just being there at the final five, and came in somewhere around like 25-35% of him just being an active contestant. I would say if you plop Joe in at final five and all he has to do is win one immunity and then at final four win either the immunity or the fire challenge, setting aside the likelihood of him potentially winning the jury vote in the end, which is a whole different discussion, I think we are looking at a very high percentage of the time that Joe is able to run the table over the course of those two rounds, one way or another. And thus, we've got to be looking at least like 10 to 15% Joe win equity right now, right? Depending on the jury status.
Yeah, it has to be. And I've been wondering over the past few days, what would a Joe losing finalist edit look like if he were to get voted out and then win his way back via Edge of Extinction?
I think it would look exactly like Joe has always looked. I don't think that we're virtually ever going to see a different side of Joe.
Okay.
Do you feel like they would go out of their way to try to justify Joe losing in the end in that timeline?
I feel like it makes sense that it would look different, but I have no idea how. It's the problem.
It makes sense that they would, just in general, want to explain why a losing finalist ended up losing. But I think in that case, they would really let Joe and his challenge performances kind of speak for itself the same way. I guess I would be anticipating somewhat of like an Aussie Cook Islands kind of edit.
Okay.
Yeah. And the other person that I could see potentially filling out the last of this winner pie here, Dom, how about Rick Devens? Is he just production's favorite, or is he still in the mix here?
Well, I know you are only 2 degrees of separation from Rick Devens, so you have some skin in the game here, but I don't see it coming together for him.
Okay, I think certainly out of the people from Edge of Extinction, Rick is the overwhelming favorite to get back in and potentially take it down there, but I am not ruling it out. I think Rick is certainly live, if not much more live than several of the people still in the main game.
Okay, you don't think that, and I know we had this debate with Redemption Island and so on, but you don't think that having been voted out once is going to be seen as disqualifying for a new player like Rick who doesn't have the Aussie hero worship factor thing going on?
It certainly could be, but when you get voted out once under the condition of essentially being swap screwed and then immediately win your way back in, I could see that being forgiven.
Okay.
Yeah. So anything else, Dominic?
I am all out.
All right. Well, I think that will do it for me as well. New episode coming in only a day or two, a little late on the podcast this week, but hopefully back sooner next week. Enjoy going back to an hour of regular Survivor, I believe, for the rest of the season. It's just one double episode per season, right?
I believe so, yeah.
All right, scheduling guru Dom with the inside info on that one. The merge should be a lot of fun. We'll be back, I'm sure, very soon to break all of that down. Thank you so much for listening. We'll talk to you soon. Take care, everybody.